This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Judith and I have become friends over the last few years and have had probably at least 8, if not 10, public conversations in the last 3 years, which all began with this project, really. We were introduced through an amazing post-colonial thinker, and together we've had conversations that have stimulated the practice of work that I do, I know, incredibly, and I'm so grateful that we get to keep on doing this and to keep on working together. And I suppose the context of this conversation, really, it's an illustrated talk that uses Cairo stories as a starting point to think about visual culture more generally in Egypt after the uprisings in 2011. So it's about locating this within this broader ecology of image making, and also the title Not Reconciled, which relates to a body of work that Judith started producing in the 80s, is really, I suppose, a theme that we will explore in this conversation, because as I hope we might end up suggesting, is that the culture of image making in Egypt in particular after 2011 has been one of continual negotiation and fluctuation. And one can not really say that there is a definitive image or representation visually from artists or from activists since 2011. So my interest in this project really began by thinking about the way that you were using video and the way that you were, I suppose, transpose the voice through these modes and these techniques that you can see behind you here. And I guess what I wanted to do, Judith, to start off with, is to kind of think about how the politics of representation has been a theme that runs throughout your work. And maybe we could start with the beginning of Not Reconciled as a place to go through that.
That's a good question. Thank you. So the project Cairo Stories is a continuation of a long project I started in 1986 called Not Reconciled, which was very indebted title-wise and somewhat theoretically to Straub Houllier's films. And Not Reconciled is an early narrative film of theirs, which sets up a condition where the narrative itself is never reconciled. And in 1986, I was invited into the Whitney Biennial. I had just moved to New York, and I was offered the choice of two places, the bathroom or the stairwell. And so I was thinking about the process of me just moving to New York and all of the hopes and dreams that you have as a person, especially moving to New York, which is such a big city and there's so many opportunities, but no matter when you move there, you feel like it's too late. Like you should have moved here like earlier. So I was collecting in a very unscientific way a lot of stories from other people who had just moved to New York. And they were people from many different races and classes. And it was very unscientific, but I was interested in this notion of the American dream and the question of someone's hopes and dreams and how that might be materialized in and through language. And so the project, and the first one was called First and Third, that I did for the Whitney, was really about these stories and the kind of speech acts and the use of the voice in a kind of political way to enact the situation. And at the time, it was a very organic project for me. But I had, earlier when I lived in San Francisco, I had spent a brief amount of time as a union organizer, where it was a very interesting learning experience, and it taught me a lot about the politics of the voice and also about talking with people, because I would, in quotes, be arguing with people about certain issues, and I would think that I had won the argument with them, and I had on a kind of logical level, but I lost them because I didn't win their hearts. And it was a very good lesson to, you know, to really think about the impact of talking with people and storytelling and what the stories mean. And so, at any rate, I filmed these very short stories about different people's immigrant experience. And it was also the time when the film projector was being supplanted by the video projector. And one of the things about that technologically is that you don't see the cone of light when a video projector projects, especially the three gun projectors. They don't make that pinpoint spot of light. So for that piece at the Whitney, I was able to hide the projector by trompe-l'oeil-ing it, and the different stories would appear on the limestone walls of the Whitney, and then they would disappear. And there was a really long pause between each story. But it, and so you, some people came to see the work and they didn't even see the work because they didn't wait the 60 seconds for the work to come on, because 60 seconds is forever. But one of the interesting things about that is that it was a really good metaphorical way to stage the relationship between immigrant experiences in relationship to the Whitney, which was mostly showing white men of a certain age. And there were very few women actually in the main exhibition space of the Whitney Museum. It was usually John Hantard, who was the film and video curator, who would invite all the women to show single channel works, because in those days, video installation was kind of unusual. But so I felt, oh, okay, this is really an appropriate comment to make about the Whitney.
And then that project continued, and in London in 1991, is that right? On the underground.
Well, yeah, the Hammersmith Tube Stop. I was invited by, it was when I was having a show at the Whitechapel, but I was invited by the Riverside Studio at the same time to do another version of First and Third, and whenever I do not reconcile, I pick a different subject matter. And so for that version, what was happening in Hammersmith is the entire area was so close to the city that it was being radically gentrified. And so for that one, I worked with all these oral history groups associated with libraries. And so it was really, I realized that at that point with the project, and I also did one that never got put on in Vancouver before then, but I realized then that I didn't necessarily have to be the auteur producing the work, and my name didn't have to be as associated with it as it often is when your name is the artist, and then you're just, you know, it's all about you. And this was really about these people and them wanting to share what was happening to them, which is they were being displaced very, very radically. And so that project was in the Hammersmith Tube Stop in a kiosk that was kind of disused. And what was amazing to me coming from New York, especially in the late 80s, was that it never got vandalized, and it was up for almost 3 months. And so it was really an interesting project to do there. And then I've done several other iterations of the project, including Cairo stories in other cities.
So what took you, so between the project in Hammersmith in the early 90s to Cairo Stories, which was completed in 2011. Can you tell us a bit about that journey and what led you to start Cairo Stories?
Well, I've done a lot of versions of this series, Not Reconciled, and I've also shown Cairo Stories in a lot of different places. And as I've mentioned a couple of other times, I really, Cairo Stories kind of found me when I was in Egypt for the first time around 2000, working on an exhibition for the Cairo Biennale. I kept meeting these women who would tell me their secrets, essentially. And I started collecting them, and then gradually I collected, you know, quite a few. And then about 2 years later, I was invited by a curator, Scott Bailey, at the AUC, who was running the Falaki Gallery, to make a project. And I told him about these women that I'd met, because I'd been thinking about them and thinking how, you know, why were they telling me their stories? And it was because I was a stranger, I know. And so they could tell me where they maybe couldn't tell their best friend, even some of the things that they were telling me. And so with Scott, we conceived of the project. And so I began the project with Scott. And then right as I began it, the Iraq War, Bush started the Iraq War in March of 2003. And then I got taken away. I got a knock on my hotel room door, and there were two men in military fatigues, and they packed me and escorted me to my plane, and I was sent home because I was interviewing people in very near Tahrir Square, because that's where the American University in Cairo used to be located. And so I was deemed in sedentary, being on the street interviewing people. And the students were rioting because Mubarak had kind of relaxed the anti-riot laws to kind of keep the peace. So, and then, you know, the project, I had to pretty much self-fund the project, except for maybe two or three times when I got grants from different people, including Daniel Langlois Foundation and a couple of other, you know, places like the Guggenheim gave me a fellowship 1 year, and Sharjah Biennale gave me money.
So then the Sharjah Biennale, that was the kind of the final push to complete the project, and it coincided with the beginnings of the uprisings in Egypt. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the completion of the project and also how it was presented in Sharjah, because it was presented in a very different manner from the way that we see it here, much more as a kind of architectural intervention, as it were.
Yeah. Well, for all of the other iterations, including the first iteration of Cairo Stories, I presented it as projections, and I like to intervene in public space in some way. And for Sharjah, it was a very particular situation, because in Sharjah, which is one of the seven principalities of the United Arab Emirates, they actually have a heritage center. And that heritage center has been slowly taken over by Horror, who's the sheikah, and she's actually rebuilt it. Mm-hmm. And for this particular iteration, she had rebuilt quite a lot of it. And we used Cairo Stories as kind of a marker of different events that were happening in other parts of the Sharjah Biennale, which took place all through the heritage area, which is this area that's really in downtown Sharjah, which is actually quite tiny. So the story is projected in two markets and in several building sites and outdoors and indoors. And because it's so bright there, we left them on in the daytime, and they functioned orally. You could hear them in the daytime, and you wouldn't necessarily know there was video. And then at night, you would be surprised to see video. And so I've tried to find interesting sites along the path where we could have a projection.
There's almost a kind of ghostly spectral quality in what you're saying. And I was thinking today about this work in relation to the broader culture of image making. And I wanted to ask you if you felt that the project, in a sense, was part of a narrative of resistance or part of a counter-narrative of some sorts.
Well, yeah, I see the stories of these women in particular, which I mean as a portrait of Cairo, and the stories were collected over this very long period, and there was a group of interlocutors, and the people who were, you know, part of the narrative were involved in the, you know, the writing of the stories. And so in many ways, not being represented or imaged very much in Cairean culture is something that women in particular have faced a great deal. And I wanted to give voice to them in a way that hadn't been given voice to. And also, because these are very intimate personal stories, many of these women did not want to be imaged at all. I couldn't even take a photograph of them. And I had to promise to change their names. And, you know, we signed contracts and everyone who was part of it got paid. And I mean, I wanted to do it in a way that was very ethical and very considerate of what they were revealing. And so I do see these stories as they're quite unusual in the sense of the kinds of things that the women reveal, which are culturally very different than, you know, what some of the Western approaches to some of the same issues.
Thinking about the formal strategies of the work, we've discussed before the formal strategy being a response to two things. One, the practical issue of people not wanting to be represented or documented in a purely representational fashion, but it's also a formal strategy that has roots and references from everywhere, from documentary theater to performance. And I thought we could talk a little bit about the idea of appropriation as a kind of formal strategy. I mean that not in the negative sense, but as an artistic strategy where we take material and offer it a different kind of meaning, or we stage it. So maybe we could talk a bit about the staging of the narrative, the use of actors, for example, the processes behind the scripts and the rationale behind those strategies.
Well, I've always used actors with the Not Reconciled series, partially because in the late 80s, early 80s, those questions about what does it mean to take a photograph, why would you take a photograph? Do you have permission to take a photograph? What does it mean? And those issues, I think, animated the notion of why I was making these. So I also wanted to call attention to that by using actors. And I think the actors create a kind of distanciation device in the kind of old-fashioned, maybe Brechtian way. But they also... these actors, in fact, are very good actors. So you remember when we were talking about this in Liverpool, there was that one lovely man who said, "Oh, I really liked your work, and you just told me they were actors. You just ruined your work for me." And remember, that was very interesting. And what was nice about that question is it let us take up a lot of these issues and really explore the question of, you know, how every story anyone tells is always told from a different point of view because you don't have a unified ego anyway. And we could talk about stuff that you all know, I'm sure, psychoanalysis and even the notion of who's speaking, and even from an Althusserian perspective, talk about hailing the subject because these use the first person address and all those ways of interpolating subjectivity very directly within an exhibition. And so for Cairo Stories, because since 1986, I've done this project so many times, I thought, okay, I'm probably gonna show this with my galleries in Europe and in the US, and so I'm gonna do something for a gallery context, which I've been an artist who's resisted that a lot. And so I thought, okay, for this one, I'm gonna make photographs, because I wanted to stage the kind of dignity of the characters and their stories. And I'm also going to use plasmas, which had not just come into being, but I love the blacks in plasmas, and I hate the grays and all the other television sets that aren't true blacks. And so I thought I better use plasmas because they were already going to be obsolete. So I set up the production of this so that we shot photographs, and we also shot the stories at the same time using actors who spoke both Arabic, English, and Arabic, and Kyrian English. I mean, Kyrian Arabic. And so what happens when you look at the work is that there are moments when the photograph and the person speaking is the same, and there's kind of an après-coup moment where you kind of go, oh. And it kind of startles you into realizing that that person in the photograph is the same person on the plasma. And it also, for some people, makes you reflect on two forms of representation, the 19th century photograph, which these refer to, and even to the history of painting and painting with light, for instance, using the photograph, and then a more 20th century notion of media and its kind of presentness and what that might mean. And so I hope that in staging it like that, that comes into being. And I, for the same reason I did the diptychs, which when you were there for Car and Socks, they weren't framed, and I decided, okay, I'm going to frame them because then they look more like an artwork, and I think people will spend more time reading them. And indeed, at Rosamond's, we had them presented as diptychs, and people were able to read them. So the aim with the exhibition was to still have a street presence, which we've had at each place, and have an oral presence, but also have other kinds of presences in the gallery that refer to a kind of gallery setting. And similarly, the map of Cairo is there so you can really see the vast geography that is Cairo, as well as some of the informal settlements where we interviewed, because the project started with the AUC students and then it moved out in rings all throughout the city of Cairo, which is a vast city where many people live in informal settlements.
You raised for me an issue about value and attention actually in the art world when you talk about the modes of display governing in some ways attention. I think it's a really interesting point to think about this idea of how you perform the image and how an image in an institution engages or becomes a form of critique of the institutions in which it's a part of. And this work has been in a show at the Hammer Museum focused around those very issues, and I wondered if you wanted to talk about the staging of the image in relation to the idea of institutional critique at all.
Yeah, well, this was included in, there was a show this year.
Yeah, Take It or Leave It.
This year, I think in January through May, at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, called Take It or Leave It, which was trying to re-examine some of the tenets of institutional critique and bring them into the present. And so, and they started, they mostly included 80s artists from that time period, including me, and I think 37 or 50 artists in total. But, you know, but the antecedents in the catalog do go back to Daniel Buren and Michael Asher and even people before then that were working in this vein. And one of the aims of the show, and I think this is extremely important for art, is for other younger curators and a younger audience to make their own readings about these kinds of works. So the curators, which were Johanna Burton and Ann Elgood, deliberately picked works from three eras from almost all of the artists. So they picked an early work of mine, Casual Shopper. They picked Imagination Dead Imagine, which is a kind of mid-90s work, and they picked Cairo Story. So I was represented by these three different kinds of approaches to the image, and each one takes up the question of the efficacy of the image and the question of representation in a different way. And I think that came through especially for younger artists who'd never seen any of this work of these 80s, in quotes, artists in person. And so I think it was, you know, very interesting for them, even though the show was extremely crowded, as I'm sure you heard, and as many reviewers pointed out. But it was really interesting, I think, for, you know, mostly younger people to come to terms with some of this work. And the other artists included Mike Kelly and Matt Mulliken and Dara Birnbaum and Sherry Levine and Louise Lawler and Sylvia Kabowski and Nathan Nayland Blake. And I mean, it was just, you know, it was jam-packed. And then some younger artists who wouldn't necessarily be so associated. People like Rick Tarageneva was in the show as well.
I mean, maybe it's now thinking about this idea of the image in three different contexts. Maybe it's an appropriate moment for us to start to look at some different strategies of image production in Cairo now. And I've prepared some stuff for us to look at and for Judith and I to
kind of talk over
or dialogue with. But really, the idea behind this is to think about the different questions that these images raise and the different manner, different ways that artists might respond to these cultures of image making. And Judith has responded in a very particular way, which I think is incredibly sophisticated. And I think if we start back at this moment in 2011. Actually, if you look at this image, this is just a Google search of Tahrir Square. The thing that I mentioned to Judith was that the images become almost atemporal and that we aren't sure what we're looking at, whether it's 2011, whether it's 2012 during another uprising, and the sense of the individual is lost. The image becomes flattened, our proximity and distance to it is kind of unclear, and the emphasis is on the mass as opposed to the individual, as, for example, say in Cairo Stories. And the way that artists kind of choose to respond is varied, and I have here a whole range of material from different people. And I don't know where to begin, actually, if we actually maybe start with Ahmed Basuni as a case study. Mm-hmm. So right after I met Judith to talk about this project, there was this occurrence in the Venice Biennale, which maybe some of you might have seen, where an Egyptian artist who had been assassinated in Tahrir Square during the first 18 days of the uprising ended up somehow a few months later representing Egypt at the Venice Biennale, which is a very unusual thing because the pavilion of Egypt is governed by a very tight regime. And if you're any credible artist, you tend to avoid being represented there because there isn't space for criticality. And what happened here was this artist, who was very young, 33 years old when he passed, who became almost, who became this huge martyr figure with these kind of images fly posted everywhere. And I remember walking down Tahrir and seeing these posters. And there was a perfect story there for people to clock into. He was a young man with two young children. And he was, interestingly, one of the few artists in Egypt working with media and technology, kind of in an open source fashion. And of course, that became an interesting and appropriate allegory for the idea of the so-called Twitter revolution and technology's potential and its utopic potential for social and political change. And what happened was that the interim Egyptian government thought it would be a nice and strategic move, or that's my reading of it, to have him represent Venice as a sign of a kind of progress. And what they did was that they took documentation of a performance that he had staged outside of the Cairo Opera House the year before he passed away and put it alongside images that he had captured on his phone in Tahrir Square. And this is what it looked like in Venice. So this image is him in this bodysuit in this performance where he was wrapped in this material that mapped out his body's motion, his heart rate and rhythms which were projected behind him. And then this kind of footage that doesn't really suggest or tell any particular narrative. But what was interesting about this is that it almost felt like a kind of processing on behalf of the curator. So the curator of this exhibition was, do you know him, Shadi Mushaeti, who was a friend and colleague of the artist, mm-hmm. who had found this footage and decided that that he wanted to propose it for the pavilion. And I've discussed this before with you, as I felt it was a kind of emotional working through, and what was powerful about it, and you saw it, didn't you, mm-hmm. was that there was a rawness to the footage and the material, and that seemed to me an initial strategy that some artists and curators in Egypt were using, which was to almost broadcast things that were seemingly unedited out, which, and I don't know if for you, you felt as you were dialoguing with your subjects afterwards, whether there was this kind of desire just to share that story or that moment. What was it like in terms of the subjects who had been involved, because in the protest?
Well, while we were shooting Cairo Stories in New York, which I had wanted to shoot in Egypt, but we couldn't for a whole variety of reasons, the uprising was going on, and so we were in direct contact with people either on their cell phones or watching things unfold on Al Jazeera. I brought over, I guess, about six people from Egypt for the shoot. And so dramaturges and different people to work on the accents, and we did a lot of rehearsal. And, it was very, very intense. And then afterwards, I think there was, in talking to them afterwards, and this is before Morsi was elected, but during the kind of run-up to the election, there was a lot of anxiety about what was going to happen. And when Venice happened, it was, it was in June, and so it had been about 3 months since things had kind of quieted down, and people were really wondering how would these young people produce a different way of government, because what produced the uprising wasn't necessarily people who had long-term political party skills like you might get in a more open democracy. They were organizing in very small cadres, and so those skills of like putting things together. So with the people that I knew who were the interlocutors, there was a lot of anxiety about the activity and the promise and the hopes of the uprising. And then, of course, the hopes didn't come to fruition. And you might remember they put the parliament together and everyone left. And, it started to really unravel. And so by the time I got to the Venice Biennale, I think I saw you there. I can't remember, but it was during the opening. But seeing that raw footage and then seeing Massam jumping up and down because he was a performance artist, essentially using video, it was very frenetic. And I remember thinking that there was all this power unleashed at this moment. And I do think that installation captured the freneticness of that moment, but it didn't really add up to anything. And that I remember thinking at the time, it was a kind of terrible letdown because I think it was six screens or eight screens, and it alternates with this performance where he's jumping up and down. And then you see the, Tahrir Square. And so, I thought it was a very strange way of presenting this. And I also wondered what Shadi thought about, like, because he edited it, as I understood.
Yeah, he did.
But then Caroline Christophe Bekarjev put a clip of that, but a more, a calmer clip. In the brain section of Documenta. And that, I thought, was actually much more successful because it really showed him doing a more calm kind of performance, and then it was intercut. And I don't know who edited that one, but
I mean, what's interesting is that I just wrote this article where I say start with Egypt is efflorescing. There is this vibrancy that came from this moment, but the energy was never channeled creatively into necessarily into a cogent thing. And I think that that's part of this idea of processing, which is a perfect allegory for kind of the digital and post-digital condition, is actually evident throughout. And maybe this is an appropriate moment to show a kind of different kind of material, where this I mentioned to you is this activist collective called Musirin, which in Arabic means the determined. And it's made up of artists and filmmakers. And what they were attempting to do was to, you know, balance the truth or create a counter-narrative or to subvert the hegemonic narrative in some way. And they were doing it through these films, which I thought had a stylistic quality of sorts as well, because they were not just any DIY pieces of footage. And what's interesting about this is I think there is a working through almost, or idea processing. Maybe we'll show a little bit of this particular thing, which is after the Maspero attacks, which was a sectarian fight between Coptic Christians and Muslims, this was produced very soon after, because the Egyptian media wasn't reporting on this. The reason I showed this clip was to think about the idea of narrative, which was that, in a sense, what we're seeing is not necessarily this is a particular story, this is a series of events, this is what happened. It's kind of a series of jump cuts between different narratives and different presentations of trauma. And for me, it kind of raises a question about the impossibility to represent these issues. And one interesting thing I wanted to ask was the feeling of, I wouldn't say responsibility, but whether you felt a kind of desire to engage, to recite the narrative in a coherent manner, in a way, or to tell something that kind of sought to occupy a very particular position, whether it be, I don't know if that makes sense. I mean,
well, I was looking for individual experiences,
and
so I was very interested in how these women negotiate their daily lives, like the stories they tell about their lives, the decisions they make, and the effects of those decisions on their psyche, from a psychoanalytic perspective, not a psychic perspective. Yeah. And, you know, I saw some of these clips when they were happening, and I think these were, you know, have a different aim, which is really to represent, because none of this was on the news media. I mean, you couldn't see these in Cairo, so this was an attempt to tell the stories of these different horrible things that were happening kind of as a very often occurrence. Beginning right around this time, there were many eruptions of violence in Cairo, which were captured by people with cell phones, and as somewhat the uprising was. But here the violence was much more intense. I mean, Massim was one of the only people who was killed during the uprising, and in Cairo stories, there are two stories by women who really talked about the way the space of Tahira made a different kind of social space, where it collapsed difference, and it, in a good way, and it collapsed a lot of the gender issues which govern behavior on the street, and made for a very open conversation. This is so, you know, it's so different, and it's like in the army, for instance, you saw on that clip that a couple of times people talk about the army during the uprisings in Tahrir. The army was there, but people wanted the army, And there really wasn't, the army didn't attack the people. Mm. And you know, and then all of a sudden the army was beginning to attack the people. So, but you know, it's a narrative that's hard to piece together, I think, without knowing the specificity of what's happening in Cairo and its relationship to the military, which is why I think, you know, the specificity of a lot of the different wars that are happening all across the region is so important to know, because if you don't, then you're just looking at this kind of gruesome footage, and you're kind of, you, I think there is kind of a battle fatigue that sets in.
I mean, the reason I bring it up is actually as almost a provocation to, you know, how artists engage within the space that occupies, you know, all these kinds of images. And one of the things that I've told you before is that lots of the artists that I work with and know in Egypt felt that it was almost impossible to produce any images during this time. And you had this experience when you were talking to William Wells at the townhouse, and you were talking about the, which was this art center in Cairo that also formed at one point an anchor for Cairo Stories as a project, that the impossibility, maybe you want to tell us a bit about that conversation about townhouse as a space, as a visual space, operating within this milieu at that moment.
Well, townhouse is a very well-known gallery that actually was located in downtown Cairo, or it's still located in downtown Cairo, and it's right next to Tahrir Square, in fact. And after the uprising, William Wells, the director, and he has three or four buildings that he's over time opened as art spaces. He felt like the situation around Tahrir was too fraught, and so he decided he would turn the space into a community center. And so for about the year after, he only had really no real art exhibitions, but there were graffiti artists who did projects and other people, but he didn't want to draw any attention to the space because he felt like it was too dangerous to invite the public. On the other hand, I was teasing him a little bit about Rosa Luxemburg, who is a writer whose work I really like, and I had Jekyll and Rose had just come out in a London Review of Books with a really good piece about Rosa Luxemburg's writing from prison, and she was constantly getting put into jail, but she had this exuberant spirit that was just unquenchable, and you couldn't keep her down. And she, even from jail, she would write passionately about all of this stuff. So William and I had this kind of disagreement about what he was doing. But I think, you know, after a while, I think he's now starting to have exhibitions there again. But as we were remarking on earlier, that moment when townhouse could really be an anchor and a presence in downtown Cairo is really radically shifted because it's, you know, that area, which is this fabulous, decrepit, colonial past with, it's like a palimpsest of French, English, Indian, you know, every kind of architectural style that you've ever seen is in downtown Cairo, and it's, you know, just a fascinating place, but it's also so close to the heart of the uprising that it's just fraught with all of these different kinds of pressures and meaning. And Beth Stryker, who you've met, I think you've met her by now. No, anyway, no. She's an artist who became an architect, and she's doing an urban project in downtown Cairo, and she's been there for the last 2 years. And she's just recently written two books, they're both over here, that are about what it's like to try to do an urban project in the city of Cairo after the uprising. And it's a fascinating read. And, you know, she's organized picnics outdoors and, you know, all kinds of things that just fly in the face of maybe common sense. But she's still been able to pull them off. And so I was also reminding her of Rosa Luxemburg when we were first talking about her project. But you know, but that brings up the question of like, what can art do, and how, you know, how can artists mobilize and use spaces, and what do you do in these moments of extreme crisis? You know, and we're seeing, you know, I think when you think about what's been happening in Ferguson and in different parts of, you know, Missouri, and why Missouri with, so, you know, it's kind of, we're seeing a kind of a level of brutality that, you know, is really very much a residue, I think, of the militarization of the police and the just the general militarization everywhere, which is happening, you know, especially in areas that have been, you know, destabilized, where the old regime comes, you know, kind of comes back. And in my opinion, I think Sisi is like, you know, in many ways a million times worse than Mubarak ever was, because he's, you know, there's, you know, maybe 50, 60,000 people have been arrested. There are hundreds and hundreds and maybe thousands of people in jail with no hope of any kind of trial, or, and they're kind of disappeared in a sense. And there are many women that are in jail, and there are many women who've tried to go to jail because they've been organizing protests, and they can't get arrested because they are women for some reason. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's a very chaotic situation. And yet when I talk to some of my more middle class Egyptian friends, they're really for Sisi because he's making the semblance of normalcy come back. And, you know, I think we can all understand that to some extent.
But I mean, it raises the question. Disturbing. It raises the question of what can art do, because in Egypt, art is definitely the preserve of the middle class, because most organizations or art institutions are in apartment buildings where you have to climb up a flight of stairs and knock on the door and request permission to enter. And I think it what was interesting in particular after 2011 was how the space that artists were given to respond was very isolated, in so much as there were all these grants and initiatives and exhibitions that were to enable exhibitions and projects about this subject and purely about this subject, which you can argue is a different kind of oppressive oppressive lens by which to go and look at things. But I think we should open up soon to some questions, but I wanted to actually just very quickly go back and show a couple of other strategies, because what has been interesting of what artists have been doing is how the technology that's been used and the strategies that have been used by a broader public have been adopted by artists. So this is a piece by Maha Ma'moon, whose work we showed in the film series here, where after the National Security Building was dilapidated, destroyed, tons of people started to go in and try and capture footage and material, files, etc. And what Maha does with this, as in other pieces, is called Night Visitor, is to reconstruct people's personal documents using footage that they'd uploaded to YouTube. And so what you start to see here is an artist trying to piece together a narrative of some sort. And we don't have time to look at it properly here, but it's actually available on the website of Ibraz, which is a publishing platform that I co-edit with two colleagues of mine here. So you'd be able to watch that. And then also in Documenta, we saw Hassan Khan, who is an Egyptian artist. He used, he actually was a big antagonistic voice about anyone making images after the revolution. And this was his attempt actually making a work about these issues. He used some of the formal strategies of image culture at the time, where he made a feature film using mobile phone footage. where he also actually played with the disembodied some of the voices of the characters and the narratives that they were saying from each other. And you also had other artists coming from outside of Egypt, such as Karen Mirza and Brad Butler, who did a residency, were doing a residency in Cairo at the time that this uprising broke out. And their response or their way of grappling with this issue, and this film is freely available online now, was to tell the story of the Egyptian Revolution through a science fiction narrative where they invited China Mieville to tell the story of this time traveler who travels through various revolutions and uprisings throughout time. And they again use this technique of appropriating footage and materials, much of which is freely available online. And this is a kind of satirical document, as it were, interspersed with performance and film footage, and it's available. It's called Deep State. And I just thought it was useful for us to kind of look at this kind of spread of material that has emerged from the context. And of course, as we see here, the context isn't purely specific to Egypt. The culture of mass image distribution and its circulation ricochets across contexts throughout the world. And actually, what's interesting as a comment, actually maybe to end to talk about, is that we can actually recite the recent history of online culture, for example, blogging, through the violence of that has occurred in the Arab world. So you mentioned the invasion on Iraq in 2003, which was a particular moment because that's when we saw the growth and surge in personal blogging about conflict and the rise of organizations such as the Huffington Post taking adopting a position alongside 24-hour news channels. And I just found out yesterday that Huffington Post are going to launch an Arabic edition to enable bloggers and based regionally to also blog in Arabic. And it's interesting to think about how developments in technology and news culture and sharing often develop in response to conflict. And so in a way, thinking about this thread of revolution, mm-hmm. is that revolution, for me, almost becomes like an energy that in some ways allows possibility. It allows for the creation of artwork, but platforms and communities to form. And I don't know if you had maybe a closing thought maybe before we kind of opened up to questions about that idea or the essence of revolution as it's embodied in this particular work or more generally at all.
Well, I think when you think back to the history of cinema, you can think about the Russian Revolution and the beginning of the USSR in terms of making a different kind of film possible and the kind of use up to which film was put and in terms of educating a basically illiterate peasant population and all of the architecture and the various kinds of films that were produced during that time and as well as the art. And so when you think about this present moment, I think we're still, I mean, it's so new mm-hmm. that I think we're still at the beginning of what some of these artists, and it doesn't mean that you have to be from Cairo or from Egypt to participate in this discourse, but we're still seeing like what might be able to be produced. And so I think the strategies of representation are still being interred in an interesting kind of way. And I also think that we're living in this, what some people call the post-internet age, but there's a great deal of within that, and the term comes out of, as I understand it, this moment when many artists who were really working on the internet suddenly began to produce works that could come out of the computer and into the art world. But it could have a broader meaning. I'm thinking of Artie Verkrant and his text, Post-Internet Art, which he wrote when he was an MFA student at UC San Diego. But, you know, there are many other people that you could include in this group of artists. But that notion of staging how the internet becomes spatialized and can come out into the world could be something that would affect some of the strategies of artists working in more traditional medias like film and cinema in terms of producing new ways for taking this information and turning it into something that actually can telescope and translate across a variety of cultures, which is what the internet does. You know, the access we spent, you spent like an hour just really quickly pulling all these clips together, which is kind of amazing that you could find so much stuff so quickly. And, you know, you do speak Arabic, so I can read it. So, but still, you know, it's kind of incredible. And I really think we're, you know, at the beginning point when perhaps there will be new forms of cinema languages, just to use the broadest term, that will start to articulate different ways of telling stories that, you know, that may have maybe not cohesion and maybe not narrative in the classical way, but will be able to shed light on some of these issues. We were talking earlier, and I was telling Omar that I really miss Al Jazeera before it became Al Jazeera America, because on the computer they had these great feeds of all these different screens of different countries, and you could kind of check in and see what was happening in all these different places. And what was great about that is it showed visually the specificity of different cultures. And I miss that, because now the model for Al Jazeera America seems to be CNN. And it's still better than CNN. It's not driven as much by sensational news stories. But I miss that, the ability to go online and see all of this stuff. And I hope that Huffington or some of the other channels will start to do this, because I think it's very much needed. You know, I think, and you said that one of the founders of Al Jazeera is partnering with the Huffington Post.
The main co-partner on Huffington Post Arabic is the former executive director of Al Jazeera. I think with that we have ultimately is that these stories are not reconciled yet.
Not yet.
I wondered if there was any questions or comments that anyone wanted to make at all about Cairo stories in particular, the process, the form, or any of the stuff we've talked about.
Do you consider yourself a documentarian, an artist in the sense of a producer, an installation artist, and what's the difference between, I just want to clarify, are you an artist, are you a producer, are you an installation artist, are you all of the above? And are you trying to present a thing that's different than, for example, what Amy Goodman presents on Democracy Now?
I mean, just to jump in as someone who is a historian of art and a historian of cinema, it's art because, like you say, the context.
Because I say so.
And, you know, these are about a subjectivity and about a relationship that is governed by Judith with over 200 women. The stories are then edited, they are performed. As Judith mentioned in her talk, she's referencing the history of cinema, of portraiture, of technology through the use of photography alongside the screens. There is incredible. There are years of experience, reference, and graft. And I actually take slight offense to this idea of jollying around, because, as Judith also mentioned, the laborious and onerous act of writing hundreds of grant applications to be able to go on a trip, of to be able to meet and do these things, took this particular project over 10 years. It's not so much, you know, it's a very particular context. And the material that I'm showing to you here is not documentary, it is artistic. This piece here took 3 years to produce to its finishing because of the numerous editing techniques that are used, the numerous sources that were governed, the numerous rights clearance issues. So I don't agree that any of that would have been seen on these news channels that you watch and which we all watch. So I think that there's maybe a blur blurring of the context. And in a way, I guess what we're trying to do here is to create this polemical context whereby how do we look at art that sits in between this real-world politic and the art institution? Where are the positions where do we glean our agency? How do we form, how do we create critique of the institutions that enable us to speak? Who has the right to speak, etc.? And I don't think it's so useful to compare, you know, these images, etc., to mainstream context, because Judith is not a journalist. She didn't study journalism. She isn't makes no claim that she's trying to rectify or justify the ills of the world. And I think that's a rather unfair burden to put any artist or historian or of art or curator, etc. But I think it is a useful point that there is a blurring and there is between these spaces. And I hope that what some of this has done is to show those complications around language and cultures of image making. So it's my response to that. I don't know if there's anyone else has anything to say or comment about. Yeah.
I wonder if you could just maybe talk a little bit about voice, about your current thoughts about voice, since that's such an important part of this
work. Well, and your book was a huge influence, The Acoustic Mirror, on this project and also several other projects. But I think the voice now, I mean, when I think about the voice now, I think about it in relationship to a multiplicity of languages in a way that, you know, I probably didn't as much until I started working on Cairo stories in the early 2000s, because in what happened in the art world is that the art world opened exponentially beginning about 1995. And all of a sudden, in the art world, there was a multiplicity of voices that weren't in the art world before. Because before, it was very dominated by Western European artists and especially North American artists.
That literal voice is sent to the museum.
Yes.
The problem with the voice in the museum.
Yeah, exactly. And suddenly, in about 1995, there were all these international biennales with all of these artists from all over the world speaking a multiplicity of voices. And you suddenly realized what a bubble we're in the U.S. anyway, with in our own particular cultural situation. And so I began to see the use of the voice as a way of beginning to articulate and describe certain kinds of social and cultural situations across a broader range than I had conceived of the voice previously. And I haven't made that many projects that have used the voice, because Cairo Stories really did occupy me for a good 10 years in terms of, I mean, I made other projects, but it was a very long-term project. But even in making the decision to have the Arabic be unapologetically always presented in the work without subtitles was a very deliberate decision, and I've had many conversations with the presenters of the work, but not Aaron, thank you, who were saying, I just don't understand why you can't put subtitles on this. I mean, why don't you just have it subtitled? And I would say, no. And in Germany, we actually did a voiceover where we had the voice in Arabic and the voice in English. And for each of the translations, we had a German actresses that were cast in relationship to all the stories. And you could dial between three different channels. You could hear it in Arabic, you could hear it in English, or you could hear it in German. And that was very interesting, because where I showed it there was both at Karen Sachs's gallery, and then Peter Weibel at the ZKM projected it outdoors, and he kept the voiceover version because I had sent him that, and so he was projecting all these different voices, and I never saw the actual installation, but somebody who saw it said that he had the different speakers, and so you could stand. It was gigantically projected on, if anybody knows that space, there's a cinema, and at the back of Karlsruhe, back of the ZKM in Karlsruhe, there's a really big building that's kind of not used that much, and so we were able to project it there, projecting out towards the cinema, and then you could hear these stories in three different languages. Yeah, so it was a nice, but your book was a tremendously influential. And there was a show that Christopher Phillips did about The Voice. I don't know if you ever heard about that. Yeah, I should get you a copy of that catalog if it's still around.
Okay, we could talk about it after.
Yeah.
I was wondering if we could actually kind of, one, go back to some of the earlier conversations that have happened here. In particular, I'm thinking of this conversation with Ann Norden and Nisra Bashir. And in that conversation, it was really interesting. There were these tensions that had emerged, mm-hmm. as to whether your exhibition is an act of representation, or whether it's an exhibition that problematizes representation, mm-hmm. or does both. Mm-hmm. Whether there's a Western subject that is being opposed to an Arab, let's say, subject, uh-huh. or whether your exhibition is really exploring that very question. Mm-hmm. There was the question of whether there is something about femininity in Egypt and being a woman in Egypt, which is radically different, mm-hmm. than, let's say, here in the U.S. And there were all these like tensions. And then over the last few weeks, I've come to understand that your exhibit is very consciously like exploring these tensions, not trying to take a side necessarily, but actually trying to, in a way, think through those questions. And I was wondering if maybe the two of you could talk a little bit more about that, since Omar's work has similarly explored, mm-hmm. these questions in various ways. So I don't know if I'm giving you a particular question, but I'm wondering if you could talk about that, but these tensions that really determine so much of this exhibition. And even, I mean, on the one hand, the exhibition is documenting a process, like an extraordinary research process. At the same time, it's also very formal, mm-hmm. in its composition. So I don't know. I don't know if there's a question there, but a prompt. So.
Well, do you want to say something? Because
no, I just think that for me it is, I read it as a working through of those contradictions in many ways. And, you know, one of my favorite ones is, maybe not one of your favorite ones, but you know which one it is. It's, mm-hmm. the Beirute woman,
yeah. mm-hmm.
who's a translator, who is talking about how she feels isolated from her family, and how really maybe she isn't such a great translator or communicator after all. And what's interesting about that is you're bringing it to language, and the idea of language. And here is this woman whose job is to communicate, but can't communicate in her personal domestic sphere. And that contradiction, and she's also of two different poles. She lived in Paris, or I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the multiplicity of herself and the complexity of the narrative, I think, is about the working through of those contradictions about the specificity. And for me, that's one of the strongest suits of the work, is that it isn't sermonizing in the sense that it's like, look how great life is for women, really, or how crap life is for women. I mean, you could have made a documentary which is about how, you know, in Egypt, if you are a woman of a particular age, if you're a young woman walking down the street at night, it is inevitable that you will get harassed, for example. And you could have made that work. But instead, you chose to go to the subject and unfold those layers, mm-hmm. which I think is one of... So I think it's about the working through of that tension. In a sense, I think that's why it fits in as part of the Not Reconciled series, is it's not... It's not a statement piece the way I see it, but maybe you feel differently.
No, I would agree. I mean, I think the negotiation that any of us have with the language that we speak, it also speaks us. And I think in all of the stories, you get that tension of, you know, also, as I mentioned earlier, these stories are very emotional. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of the women, like the woman that you're talking about, Mona, she actually cries, which I didn't really want many stories where people cry, because again, it's just too maudlin, and but she actually does, because it makes sense for her character and the actor who played her, and also the woman who told the story. Mm. But she would switch in exactly the way she does in that story, from telling a joke 1 minute and laughing, and then the next minute she's crying. Mm. And you were just like, wow, like the ability to be able to do that as a person telling a story was sort of kind of amazing. And you know, there were lots of moments where people were telling things that they felt unsure about. And so when Anne Norton and I were talking, and I think Anne comes at it from a very different perspective, wanting to see similarities between women in the U.S. and women in Egypt, which on a broader stroke picture, you could say, yes, of course, that's true. But on this, in the specificity of these stories, they're actually very different experiences. Mm. And my sense was that, because I did learn so much from these women, that learning about how they negotiate daily life was so fascinating. Mm. And it's so different, even if they're from a very wealthy family, you know, and the situation is that they have fewer choices, and which is not exactly what happens, you know, in the West. And the people from poorer families have more choices, because the family isn't as powerful and they can really create themselves in a kind of more Western way. And, you know, all those differences were really interesting. And so when Anne and I were talking, there was a lot of tension in trying to figure out how we could talk about our differences in our approach to this material, because she's written a really interesting book about how the West perceives the Arab world. And so, you know, it was fascinating. And then some of the other people that were in the conversation with us were people who had made documentary projects at Scribe, which also had to do with very specific social conditions that had led them to join these different groups that they were part of. And so they were enacting in their videos, but also in person, by being here and participating, their experiences of choosing to identify with a certain kind of politic. And so it was a very interesting evening, which I hope comes through in the recording. But I guess for me, I sort of started with Edward Said when I started the research, which is kind of, until recently, where everyone started back, you know, before the events of 2011. And then it grew out from there. And Edward would come to speak at the AUC just about once a month. So I must have seen him speak during many of the times I was there, until he got too ill to travel. But he was constantly in Egypt and constantly at the AUC. And you could just, the AUC, which has now moved to a gated community like way out of Cairo, used to be right next to Tahrir Square. And it was just the perfect place to be located, because it was so convenient and it was downtown. And, you know, Cairo was really different. And on an urban level, I would say the gated community situation and the gulfification that's happened is just, you know, it's actually in many ways destroyed the fabric of the city a lot.
Yeah, the urban development could be
another topic.
A very long conversation, the urban redevelopment. But I wondered if we wanted to just talk more informally after and just kind of bring this bit to a close, because we're a nice small group. So
we'll be here.
So thank you so much, Judith, for talking to me
and to all of you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.